a false claim of rape, only to have the claim later proved true. There's no such statistic kept. But even Marie's case, the extreme example where persecution becomes prosecution, where a victim is not only accused of lying, but criminally charged with it, does not stand alone. At least three other cases like it have surfaced in media reports since the 1990s. In Madison, Wisconsin, a legally blind woman, known as Patty, reported being raped at knife point in 1997. But the police didn't think she acted like a rape victim should, according to Cry Rape, a book journalist Bill Leaders wrote about the case. The lead detective interrogated her and deceived her. He made up a story about how the police had tested for latex residue from the supposed rapist's condom, and the test came back negative. There was no such test. He told her the nurse had found no sign of injury. The nurse had. He confronted Patty about her history of depression and use of Prozac, and questioned just how blind she was. Patty buckled, saying she'd lied, and was charged with obstructing an officer. "What she's being presented with is a world gone mad," her attorney told a judge. "It is truly a Kafkaesque situation. I'm blind. No, you're not. I was raped. No, you weren't. There was physical evidence. No, there wasn't." Only after Patty was charged did police test her bedsheet and discover semen, after which the charge against her was dismissed. In 2004, a convicted sex offender was tried and found guilty of Patty's rape. A lawsuit that Patty filed against the police was dismissed. But city officials passed a resolution extending Madison's heartfelt apology and deepest regrets, along with $35,000. In 1997, the same year Patty was raped, a teenager in New York City was raped on her 16th birthday. Detectives in Queens learned that the teenager, Fancy Figueroa, was 2 weeks pregnant and assumed her rape claim was pretext. Figueroa, who has since made her identity public, pleaded guilty to false reporting and was sentenced to 3 days of picking up garbage. In 2003, a DNA check incriminated Figueroa's attacker, a man who had gone on to rape 2 other teens. He was convicted in 2004 and sentenced to 22 years. In the years before her attacker's arrest, Figueroa battled depression and moved to North Carolina in order to get away. "I felt they hurt me more than the rapist hurt me," she said of the two detectives who accused her of lying. "He just came and left, but for 6 years, nobody believed me. I lost my family. I lost my freedom. I lost a little of my sanity." Figueroa's mother described her conflicting emotions to the New York Daily News. "I feel happy that Fancy can close a chapter in her life, but to tell the truth, I would have liked it better had it turned out she lied. It would have been better that she had never been raped." In 2004, the year Patty's rapist was convicted in Wisconsin, the year Figueroa's rapist was convicted in New York, a 19-year-old named Sarah Reedy worked as a gas station cashier in Cranberry Township, Pennsylvania. Reedy, who was pregnant, was paying her way through college. One night, a man robbed the station of about $600 and, at gunpoint, sexually assaulted Reedy. Afterward, at the hospital, a detective interviewed her. His first question to me was, "How many times a day do you use dope?" Reedy would recall later. He accused her of stealing the money and contriving a story of sexual assault as cover. And he actually went to the extent of saying, "Your tears won't save you now," when I finally started crying. It was like a horrible Lifetime movie. Reedy was arrested on charges of theft and false reporting and spent 5 days in jail before bailing out. A month before Reedy was to stand trial, A construction worker was arrested while assaulting a woman in a convenience store in Brookville, Pennsylvania. He subsequently confessed to attacking a series of women across the state, including Reedy. The charges against her were dropped. Reedy, who elected to make her identity public, sued the police and received a settlement for $1.5 million. The dismissiveness at the heart of these cases has long roots. In her 1975 book, Against Our Will, Men, Women, and Rape, Susan Brown Miller described going to a police station in New York's Greenwich Village and asking for rape statistics. The precinct, she learned, had received 35 complaints that month and made 2 arrests. "Not a very impressive record," she told a sergeant. "You know what these complaints represent," the sergeant told her. "Prostitutes who didn't get their money." For Brown Miller, the sergeant's attitude reflected something profoundly troubling in law enforcement. A police officer who does not believe there is such a crime as rape can arrive at only one determination, she wrote. Recent parallels also abound, cropping up in media accounts and academic literature in the years since Marie was raped. From 2009 to 2014, the Baltimore County Police Department dismissed 34% of rape allegations as false or baseless. The percentage itself was troubling enough. More troubling yet was how it was reached. The department often deep-sixed complaints without even taking the elemental step of having a sex crimes detective interview the alleged victim, a BuzzFeed News investigation found. In 2014, a social work professor in Michigan published a study based on interviews with police in a mid-sized city in the Great Lakes region. One officer talked of cheating wives who have been out all night. You know, blah, blah, blah. Oh, I was raped. Another said, "We find that girls utilize the rape card to mess with people. They use it to get back at a boyfriend, or they need attention. They're having a bad week, you know. If I cry rape, my whole family will come to me, and I need that." In 2016, the sheriff in Bingham County, Idaho, told a local television station, "The majority of our rapes, not to say we don't have rapes, we do, but the majority of our rapes that are called in are actual consensual sex." Marie was back in Puyallup, south of Seattle. Now 20, approaching 21, she had moved in with a former foster family, the same one she'd been with that first day of high school, back when everything seemed to be falling into place. But now, as then, something went sideways. Marie and the family got into an argument, so Marie moved in with another of her old foster families who lived down the street. It was as though Marie had gone back in time, bouncing from foster home to foster home. She was unsettled as ever. She still didn't have her driver's license. Her employment prospects remained limited as she drifted from one retail job to another. Her life was on loop. Days after she moved in with her latest family, Marie saw she had a phone message from the Linwood police. They said they were looking for her, that they needed to talk. They didn't say why. Marie flashed back to the call from Sergeant Mason 3 days after she had been raped, saying he needed to talk to her. She had the same question now. "Am I in trouble? Maybe I missed some court date," she thought. Whatever it was, Marie didn't want the police feeling agitated at having to hunt her down. She could just see them charging through her door with an arrest warrant. So she called them back and provided her new address. On March 18th, they arrived, 2 years, 7 months, and 1 week after Marie had been raped. There were 3 of them, Commander Ryder, Sergeant Kohnheim, and a woman who worked as a domestic violence coordinator, Linwood's closest equivalent to a victim's advocate. They asked if there was a quiet place to talk. Marie walked them to her room and shut the door. Ryder had prepared for this moment, but when the moment came, he didn't know what to say. How do you say, "Now we believe you. Now we hope you can trust us and work with us and help us bring to justice the man who raped you. Now we want to treat you as a victim to be helped instead of as a liar." He knew that whatever healing Marie had done, we were just about to rip that wide open. Asked years later for the words he used, Ryder couldn't remember, but he remembered the look on Marie's face. "Stunned," he says. When his words to her registered, she wept, experiencing, all at once, shock, relief, and anger. They told Marie her record would be erased. They handed her a check for $500, a refund of her court costs. They handed her an envelope with information about counseling for rape victims. The last time Konheim had seen Marie was when she had tried to take back her confession to lying. He had watched as Detective Rittgarn threatened her with jail if she failed a polygraph. Seeing Marie again, Konheim understood she had been victimized twice, first by a rapist, then by his police department. "How can we ever make her whole?" he wondered. He didn't think it was possible. "I have something to tell you," Marie said on the phone. "The police just came by," Marie told Shannon. "They said the man who raped me has been arrested in Colorado. Now, they believe me." For Shannon, there could be no simple reaction to this news, no single emotion. Relief, grief, and guilt all washed over her. O'Leary's arrest meant Marie had been vindicated. It meant Marie had been raped. It meant Marie had been abandoned at the most desperate time of her life, Shannon says. "It's very complicated," Shannon says. "Knowing they caught him, and at the same moment, knowing it actually happened, that she was raped, and nobody believed her, especially the people in her life that had been supporting her, taking care of her, and trying to mend her, help her. And we didn't believe her. It was horrible." Shannon asked Marie if they could meet. What Shannon had to say, she wanted to say in person. As they'd done so often together, the two went for a walk in the woods. About 100 feet down the trail, they stopped. "I was ready to apologize," Shannon says. Shannon told Marie how sorry she was that she hadn't believed her. She apologized for telling Marie she could no longer spend the night. She said she would understand if Marie never forgave her and never talked to her again. Marie gave Shannon a hug. She told her it was okay, that she forgave her. There was no, "I told you so." No, "Why didn't you believe me?" Marie's absolution was immediate and unconditional. "I was just so shocked that she was willing to forgive me for that," Shannon says, "because it was such a huge thing. It went on for so long." "I'm a forgiving person," Marie says. "I was born with that, or something. It might take a while to forgive or trust, but I do forgive." Marie called Wayne, her former case manager at Project Ladder. "I knew you weren't lying," Wayne told Marie. Wayne's words landed with a jolt. Marie didn't know what to say. She had a rush of thoughts. "Then why didn't you say something? Why didn't you stick up for me? You're my case manager." But left them unspoken. For Wayne, perhaps it was easier to remember it this way, or to say as much. But his words were belied by what he had written before. His case note, typed 1 week after the attack, said he didn't believe that Marie had been raped. Marie called Jordan. Jordan told Marie how sorry he was that all of this had happened to her. Talking to Jordan, Marie had never wavered, never taken back her account of being raped. and Jordan had never wavered in believing her. Yes, he had considered the possibility she was lying, but he had just as quickly dismissed it. She wasn't that kind of person. Sometimes you just know. And on top of that, I knew who she was before, and I knew who she became after, and they weren't the same, because she was hurt. But in addition to threatening Marie's freedom, the police had damaged her friendships. They left her believing that Jordan had distrusted her. Jordan told her that wasn't so. Still, she had wondered, nursing doubts about all that had been said outside of her hearing. In the years after, Marie and Jordan had drifted apart. Marie hadn't read the police reports, so she didn't know that they made no mention of Jordan doubting her story. Jordan had told Marie the truth. He had not branded her a liar. Marie called Peggy. She said she was sorry, Marie says. She didn't seem like she was in that much of a shock when I said it, like when someone shrugs their shoulders or something. The muted response disappointed Marie. Marie wanted something more from Peggy, but Peggy, initially at least, was unable to give it. She didn't want to reflect on her role, knowing where her thoughts would lead. Marie's settlement with Shannon had been clean. Both Shannon's apology and Marie's forgiveness were unreserved. With Peggy, the reckoning would be complicated. Years later, Peggy would not remember for sure how she learned of O'Leary's arrest. Maybe Shannon told her, even before Marie called. Or maybe it was Peggy's mom who broke the news. Peggy does remember her mom cutting out an article about O'Leary's capture and giving it to her. There was still so much guilt attached to it that I sort of put it over here and said, okay, yes, this really did happen, but it's still really painful to acknowledge it. I think there was a lot of denial on my part, Peggy says. It was just so painful. I knew when I heard all the evidence that it was true, but it was still just horrifying that it really did happen, and that I was involved in not believing her. In time, Peggy would look back with deep regret on the call she had made, telling the police she doubted Marie's story. I feel that if I would have shut my mouth, they would have done their job instead of relying on what was just my attempt to be very honest with them, she says. I was trying to be a good citizen, actually, you know? I didn't want them to waste their resources on something that might be this personal drama going on. I should have known better. You should always believe the victim until proved otherwise. That was a mistake I made. I did make that mistake, and I'm very sorry for it. Peggy would reach out to Marie and offer something more than she had in that first phone call, something akin to Shannon's walk in the woods. Eventually, we did have a sit-down dinner, and I took her out, and I apologized to her for not believing her. We tried to have a heart-to-heart about it, and I know that it took her still a little bit longer to forgive me. We have a decent relationship now, but it took a long time. Marie told the Linwood police she wanted an apology, not from the department itself, and not from some higher-up speaking on the department's behalf. She wanted an apology from the detectives who hadn't believed her. On the appointed day, Marie went into a conference room at the Linwood police station and waited. From Ritgarn, she would receive no apology. He was now in Southern California, working as a private investigator. His LinkedIn profile said he did surveillance for divorce and workers' compensation cases. He also did contract work for the federal government, conducting background employment investigations, according to his profile. Mason, though, was still there. He came into the conference room looking like a lost little puppy, Marie says. He was rubbing his head and literally looked like he was ashamed about what they had done. He told Marie he was sorry, deeply sorry, Marie says. To Marie, he seemed sincere. His apology helped, a little bit, she says. You can't go back 2.5 years and fix all I had to go through. An apology doesn't really fix that. Marie could have used this meeting to delve into the reasons Mason hadn't believed her, but she couldn't bring herself to ask because, she says, I don't know if I'd want the answer. Chapter 15, 327.5. March to December 2011, Golden, Colorado. Bob Weiner's phone buzzed at 7 o'clock one March morning. He was standing on the side of a soccer field in a suburb west of Denver, watching his daughter squeeze in a scrimmage before school. Detective Stacy Galbraith was calling. Oh my God, you don't know what we just found, she began. They had discovered another victim of O'Leary's predations. She described how Evans had found the photos of Marie in Washington, bound, gagged, and terrified. You will never believe this, she finished. She was prosecuted for false reporting. You're kidding me, Weiner said. It was the latest twist in a case that Weiner considered one of the most horrific in his 15-year career at the Jefferson County District Attorney's Office. Weiner was one of the most senior prosecutors in the office, which covered 2 counties west of Denver. Prosecutors and cops don't always get along. To cops, prosecutors can be too picky. To prosecutors, the cops can play fast with the rules. None of that had happened in this case. Galbraith and Weiner had been in contact almost since the beginning. They had talked frequently during the 6-week hunt, consulting each other over search warrants and the timing of O'Leary's arrest. With O'Leary locked up, Weiner had turned his attention to building his case. Galbraith and Hendershot had done what Weiner called a fantastic, unbelievable investigation. But O'Leary was facing life in prison. With the stakes so high, it seemed unlikely he would take a plea. The state's case had to withstand every attack the defense could mount and convince a jury to convict. As Weiner reviewed the facts, he saw holes. It wasn't ready for trial, he said. At first, he worried about the physical similarities between Mark and Michael. Any good defense attorney would try to raise reasonable doubt by arguing that Michael O'Leary had been the actual rapist. Perhaps Michael had carried out the attacks while his doppelganger brother ran his pornographic website empire. We need to alibi the brother, he told Galbraith and Hendershot. He had Galbraith pull every time card from the furniture store where Michael O'Leary worked as a delivery truck driver. All the way back to August 2008. No luck. Michael hadn't been on the job when most of the incidents took place. Hendershot and Ellis pitched in to help Weiner, launching what they called Project Mazda. Hendershot pulled up every registration in Colorado of a 1993 white Mazda pickup. There were 77. She gathered 10 patrol officers from Westminster and began sending them all over the state to take pictures of the trucks. The strategy was simple. If the defense tried to argue that the white Mazda on the videotape from Amber's attack was different from O'Leary's, Weiner would pull up pictures of every Mazda in Colorado. Only O'Leary's truck would match. But the discovery of the pictures in the memory cards from O'Leary's cameras, of Amber, of Sarah, and now of Marie, brought the officers' travels to a halt. Weiner would view the images in his office, his screen turned away from his door to prevent passers-by from seeing them. Although the photos did not show O'Leary's face, they did show his birthmark. Weiner even had a crime scene technician do a comparison of the moles on O'Leary's body with the ones visible on the body of the rapist. The mole map, with lines and arrows connecting similar marks, showed that Mark and the attacker were the same. Weiner knew he had O'Leary. There was no need to worry about mistaken identity. Once we found the photographs, it was like, okay. Weiner had one more concern about the images. He asked Galbraith and Hendershot to check O'Leary's porn sites to see whether he had posted any of the photos. One morning, the two women met at the FBI's regional headquarters in Stapleton, a neighborhood built on the site of Denver's old airport. In a long, low room filled with computers, they sat down back to back, each facing a terminal screen. They began to search every website that O'Leary owned, or even that he linked to. "We looked at porn all day," Galbraith says. "All day. All day," Hendershot adds. "We literally looked at, honest to God, porn all day long." "Gross stuff," Galbraith says. In the end, they did not find any images of the victims. They couldn't rule out that the photos might be posted in some dark corner of the internet. But at least they could tell the women that they had found no evidence that O'Leary carried out his threats. It brought a measure of peace of mind to the victims and to Weiner. The son of an FBI agent, Weiner had been involved in some of the biggest rape and murder cases in the region. In the courtroom, he cut a striking figure, seeming to vibrate with intensity. He was tall, thin, with a high forehead, and the ropey build of a long-distance runner, which is exactly what he was. Weiner ran marathons. For practice, he'd jog through the high mountains that surrounded his home in a Denver suburb perched in the Rockies, some 7,000 feet above sea level. At 42, he'd finished the Boston Marathon at 2 hours, 31 minutes, 20 seconds, second in his age division. He was so good that he was sponsored by a running shoe manufacturer. Running gave him clarity. It helped free his mind from the haunting images of the victims and allowed him to focus on the mechanics of the case. And there was much to think about, even with the pictures in hand. Weiner worried, for instance, about the amount of time that passed during each rape. Each woman had endured 3 or 4 hours of abuse. The typical juror is going to sit there and think, "Well, she didn't yell. Why didn't you scream? Why didn't you fight? You could have easily gotten away." And he worried that O'Leary had such detailed knowledge of each victim. The jurors might wonder, "Did she know this guy?" Those kinds of concerns hinder many rape investigations. Researchers call it downstreaming, the tendency of each person in the investigative chain to think about how the rape accusation will look to the next person to examine it. It begins with the victim, her fears about whether she might be judged by the cops about the length of her dress or the number of tequila shots she drank. It next infects the police, who wonder what the prosecutor will think of a case with no physical evidence, only one person's word against another's. And finally, it extends to the prosecutor, who must ponder how a juror will perceive a woman's testimony. Doubt afflicted every stage of a rape prosecution. Weiner believed he could prove the facts of the case. He had actual pictures of the rapist committing the crime, after all. But the skepticism attached to rape victims made a trial no easy thing. He was particularly concerned about the women O'Leary had attacked, who would have to serve as witnesses. How would they hold up? They would face hostile questioning. They would endure having painful, intimate details of the attacks splayed before a courtroom of strangers and written up in the press. They would take the witness stand with O'Leary sitting only a few feet away. In the end, would they agree to testify? The trial was set for October 2011. Weiner knew he had to prepare. After all, he was not only battling O'Leary's defense, he was also up against hundreds of years of legal history. Marie's case concerned one police department, which bungled one investigation, which led one court to hold her a liar. But her experience was no aberration. When it comes to reports of rape, the criminal justice system has long embraced the cherished male assumption that female persons tend to lie, as Susan Brown Miller once wrote. In courtrooms throughout America, the historical default setting has been doubt. The jurist with the greatest impact on our legal system's response to rape allegations lived four centuries ago. Sir Matthew Hale, a contemporary of Oliver Cromwell and Charles II, became Lord Chief Justice of England in 1671. He was, by far, the most renowned and respected judge of the time, one account says. In legal circles, his name became venerated. A biographer wrote in 1835, "So resplendent, in short, were his excellencies, that to this day, if an instance of singular virtue and uprightness, especially in the legal profession, is to be adduced, the mind turns as instantly to Lord Hale as the needle to the pole." Language equally fulsome can be found in accounts written since. Hale, known for his piety, integrity, and sober judgment, wrote a massive two-volume criminal law treatise, The History of the Pleas of the Crown. He called rape a most detestable crime, then added words quoted many times hence. "It must be remembered that it is an accusation easy to be made and hard to be proved, and harder to be defended by the party accused, though never so innocent." Hale evoked the fear of the false accuser, which has roots even in the Bible, where Potiphar's wife, rejected by Joseph, accuses him of rape, and made for that fear a legal frame. He described two cases of men he believed to have been wrongly accused, one by a 14-year-old girl with designs of blackmail. "Jurors," Hale wrote, "should consider, is the woman claiming rape of good fame or evil fame? Did she cry out, try to flee, make immediate complaint afterward? Does she stand supported by others? Judges and jurors must be vigilant," Hale wrote, "lest the crime's heinousness fuel them with so much indignation that they are over hastily carried on to the conviction of the person accused thereof by the confident testimony, sometimes of malicious and false witnesses." The English judge was full of advice, even beyond the law. He wrote a letter to his young grandchildren, 182 pages long, prescribing counsel for each. For Mary, "If she cannot govern the greatness of her spirit, it will make her proud, imperious, and revengeful." For Francis, "If she be kept in some awe, especially in relation to lying and deceiving, she will make a good woman and a good housewife." As for Anne, he perceived a soft nature, and therefore forbade plays, ballads, or melancholy books, for they will make too deep an impression upon her mind. Hale, in his letter, shudders at the world around. "The whole constitution of the people of this kingdom is corrupted into debauchery, drunkenness, gluttony, whoring, gaming, profuseness, and the most foolish, sottish prodigality imaginable." He especially despises what has become of young women. "They learn to be bold and talk loud. They make it their business to paint or patch their faces, to curl their locks, and to find out the newest and costliest fashions. If they rise in the morning before 10 of the clock, the morning is spent between the comb and the glass and the box of patches. Though they know not how to make provision for it themselves, they must have choice diet provided for them." His complaint continues, with one sentence lasting 160 words. Hale was married twice. There was gossip his first wife cheated. He was mocked as a great cuckold. He refers to English gentlewomen as the ruin of families. There is evidence that Sir Matthew Hale might have been somewhat below the norm for the times in terms of his views of women. Gilbert Geis and Ivan Bunn write in their book, A Trial of Witches. The book details an event that blotted Hale's legacy, be it only so slightly. In 1662, at Bury St. Edmunds, Hale presided at the trial of two elderly women accused of witchcraft. He instructed the jury that witches were real, saying Scripture had affirmed as much. Upon the jury's verdict of guilty, Hale sentenced Amy Denny and Rose Cullender to hang. He had condemned another convicted witch 4 years before. 30 years later, Hale's handling of this trial, preserved in written record, served as a model in Massachusetts. Indeed, the Salem witch hunts might not have taken place if there had not been a trial at Bury St. Edmunds. The events at Salem notoriously imitated those at Bury, Geis and Bunn write. Hale's influence upon witchcraft trials would expire as belief in witches waned. But his influence on rape cases would endure. As long as 300 years after Hale's death in 1676, many a jury in the United States would be cautioned with his words. Courts called it the Hale Warning, an instruction to jurors in rape trials to be wary of the false accusation, hard to be defended and easily made. On December 16, 1786, Thomas Jefferson, while away in Paris, penned a letter to James Madison. He complained of a dislocated right wrist. The swelling does not abate, permitting him to write only with great pain. He wrote of setting out soon for the south of France in hopes the mineral waters there would heal. He wrote of commerce, fish, flour, turpentine, tobacco, between the United States and France. Then, almost in passing, he wrote of his opposition toward harsh punishment for rape, on account of the temptation women would be under to make it the instrument of vengeance against an inconstant lover, and of disappointment to a rival. The man who had authored the Declaration of Independence was writing to the man who would author the Bill of Rights, to warn of the woman scorned, crying rape. 7 years later, a criminal prosecution in New York City captured how the early American legal system used Lord Hale's criteria to undermine a woman's credibility. Henry Bedloe stood trial in 1793, accused of raping Lana Sawyer. Bedloe was an aristocrat, described in annals as a libertine and rake. Sawyer was a 17-year-old seamstress, daughter of a seaman. The two met when Sawyer, taking a summer stroll, was harassed on the street, and Bedloe interceded. He gave a false name, telling Sawyer he was a lawyer named Smith. She agreed to accompany him days later on a nighttime walk. On that night, Bedloe pulled her into a brothel and raped her, she said. He said he seduced her. At trial, 5 defense lawyers spoke on Bedloe's behalf. One warned the 12 men of the jury that this case put the life of a citizen in the hands of a woman, to be disposed of almost at her will and pleasure. Another said, "Any woman who is not an abandoned prostitute will appear to be averse to what she inwardly desires." A third asked how a sewing girl could imagine a lawyer paying her any attention unless with a view of promoting illicit commerce. She walked with him late into the night. Is it probable that a girl who had thus abandoned the outworks of her chastity and left every pass to it unguarded would be long in surrendering the citadel? The defense attorney who spoke the longest was Henry Brockholst Livingston, who would later be named to the U.S. Supreme Court. He was appointed by Thomas Jefferson. Addressing the jury, Livingston quoted Hale, "an accusation easy to be made," and applied Hale's prescribed inquiry to Lana Sawyer. Was she of good fame? Although a cloud of witnesses said she was, she may have had the art to carry a fair outside while all was foul within, Livingston told the jury. She said she screamed, but did she also stamp her feet? And why, upon agreeing to stop for ice cream, did she draw the night out? Instead of taking a single glass of ice cream and returning, as would a girl jealous of her reputation, she stays with him here a full hour and a half. Livingston argued that Sawyer made up the story of being raped upon finding that Bedloe had no further occasion for her. You all know how strong the passion of revenge exists in a female breast. A deserted woman sets no bounds to her anger. The trial lasted 15 hours. The jury deliberated 15 minutes. The verdict was not guilty. The 20th century's leading expert in the field of evidence was John Henry Wigmore. A mustachioed scholar, accomplished in 12 languages, he helped found the Harvard Law Review and served as dean of Northwestern University's law school for 28 years. Law professors and students call his masterwork Wigmore on Evidence, which is easier to say than a treatise on the Anglo-American system of evidence in trials at common law, including the statutes and judicial decisions of all jurisdictions of the United States and Canada. A University of Chicago law professor called Wigmore's tome perhaps the greatest modern legal treatise, saying its analysis forms the very structure of the law of evidence today. Wigmore also read up on psychiatry and psychology, becoming the best legal friend that psychology had. In cases where women alleged rape, he urged psychiatry's merger with the law. In his treatise's third edition, what became his final authoritative version, published in 1940, Wigmore expanded on some language he had written in the 1930s on women and credibility. He took the notion expressed by Henry Brockhurst Livingston a century and a half before, fair outside while all was foul within, and added Sigmund Freud. Modern psychiatrists have amply studied the behavior of errant young girls and women coming before the courts in all sorts of cases. Their psychic complexes are multifarious, distorted partly by inherent defects, partly by diseased derangements or abnormal instincts, partly by bad social environment, partly by temporary physiological or emotional conditions. One form taken by these complexes is that of contriving false charges of sexual offenses by men. The unchaste, let us call it, mentality finds incidental but direct expression in the narration of imaginary sex incidents, of which the narrator is the heroine or the victim. On the surface, the narration is straightforward and convincing. The real victim, however, too often in such cases, is the innocent man. To summarize, she imagined it. No doubt, Wigmore wrote, every judge and prosecutor had seen cases of this. Henceforth, he wrote, no judge should ever let a sex offense charge go to the jury unless the female complainant's social history and mental makeup have been examined and testified to by a qualified physician. Wigmore died in 1943. 40 years later, Lee Beenan, then a public defender, later a faculty member at Wigmore's Northwestern University, examined the scientific source materials upon which Wigmore built his argument and found them wanting. But despite Wigmore's dubious research and repressive and misogynist position, his views remained influential with lawyers and judges. If there is a single source of the law's concern with false reports in sex offense cases, it is the Wigmore Doctrine, Beenan wrote. For women alleging rape, the doctrine's core premise, she imagined it, was simply another variation of she wanted it, a presumption long voiced in courts and legal literature. Although the woman never said yes, nay, more, although she constantly said no and kept up a decent show of resistance to the last, it may still be that she more than half consented to the ravishment. Green Carrier Bronson, a New York Supreme Court justice, wrote in 1842. In 1952, a Yale Law Journal article said that many women require aggressive overtures by the man. Often their erotic pleasure may be enhanced by, or even depend upon, an accompanying physical struggle. In the 1970s and 80s, the feminist movement generated powerful pushback, helping reform rape laws around the country. While Marty Goddard and Susan Erian helped institute rape kits and trauma training, legislatures adopted rape shield statutes, restricting evidence about a rape accuser's sexual history, as courts abandoned jury instructions that used the language of Sir Matthew Hale. As some legal commentators have noted, the repudiation of Hale was about three centuries late. His words aren't true now. When most rapes go unreported, the accusation cannot be considered easy to be made. But his words weren't true then either. The era offered plenty of examples of women made to suffer for coming forward. In 1670, two indentured servants in Virginia accused their master of rape. For this, they were punished with extra years of servitude. In the early 1700s, in trials 7 years apart, two women in Maine reported being raped. One received an admonition for public rudeness, the other 15 strips for lewdness. And though Hale may have faded, his legacy yet lurks. In 2007, 1 year before Marie reported being raped, a state legislator in Maryland, a criminal defense attorney who chaired the House Judiciary Committee, invoked Hale's warning during a hearing on whether to deny parental rights to rapists whose victims conceive. The lawmaker, Joseph Valerio Jr., said he quoted Hale as a history lesson. But his words caused outrage, according to a headline in the Washington Post. A Maryland anti-rape advocacy group criticized Valerio for citing archaic and misogynistic doctrine. The law didn't pass. 10 years later, when state delegate Kathleen Dumay tried for the ninth time to push the measure through, an all-male panel drawn from both houses of the legislature let the bill die, leaving Maryland as one of 16 states that does not allow a rape victim to terminate the parental rights of her attacker. One morning in July, Weiner got a phone call from O'Leary's public defender, Jeffrey Dugan, a young trial lawyer with 3 years' experience. Dugan brought a message from O'Leary. "My guy wants to plead guilty. He wants to get it over with. He doesn't want to put the victims through this," Weiner recalled Dugan saying. Dugan had advised O'Leary against taking a plea, but O'Leary was insistent. There was only one condition. Weiner had to drop all of the charges pertaining to kidnapping. O'Leary's request surprised Weiner, but he figured he knew the reason for it, and it wasn't a sudden change of heart. Weiner knew that O'Leary was nervous. In a recorded jail phone call, O'Leary had told his mother that he thought the detectives were going to find stuff on his computer. He just wasn't sure how much. He found out when Weiner had turned over discovery to O'Leary's public defender. Contrary to the gotcha moments in courtroom dramas, the justice system frowns on surprises. To allow for investigation before trial, each side must show the other certain evidence it is prepared to present. Weiner had recently provided Dugan with the photos Evans had recovered, alerting O'Leary for the first time that police had managed to salvage images of him, or at least a person with his exact body marks, raping women. Images that he thought were safely locked behind layers of unbreakable computer encryption. Now, he was exposed. Still, Weiner didn't understand what O'Leary would get out of the deal. Even if Weiner dropped the kidnapping charges, O'Leary would still face life in prison. There would be no reduction in his sentence. So what was the point? Why not fight it out, no matter how overwhelming the evidence? What, after all, did you have to lose? It was unusual, Weiner says, but it was an unusual case as well. Weiner figured it was something psychologically important. Maybe O'Leary could accept being a rapist, but not a kidnapper. Whatever the reason, Weiner figured he might have some leverage. Like Evans, Weiner had become obsessed with The Wretch, the encrypted file from O'Leary's computer. Weiner wasn't tech savvy. He called the computer file a container. But he knew that anybody who'd gone to that much trouble to conceal its contents had something worth hiding. He wasn't sure just what. Could there be other women? Other rapes? Or evidence of some kind of secret club of men who raped women and swapped pictures? Was there child pornography? He needed to know what was inside. "I'm thinking it's pretty bad," he says. Weiner called Dugan back with a counteroffer. He would consider a plea deal, but O'Leary had to turn over the password to the Wretch. Dugan got back to him quickly, unequivocally, no. The speed and surety of the response heightened Weiner's suspicions. "It told me that there was something pretty significant there," he says. Galbraith shared the news with Hendershot, Burgess, and Hassel in an email on July 7, 2011. "O'Leary will not give up the encryption code, period." Though O'Leary wouldn't give up his secret, Weiner believed he still had the terms of a good deal. Drop the kidnapping charges in return for the guilty plea. Before he signed off, Weiner consulted with the victims, one by one, in his office. Each woman had a different reaction. Doris was hesitant to drop any charges. She had no fear of a trial. "She's really tough, like, I'm not afraid of this guy," Weiner recalled. Amber was nervous that news of the case might reach her friends and family. Sarah was still emotionally blasted, ready to take the deal. And Lily was distrustful. She was upset at Hassel. If he had investigated her case more thoroughly, he might have stopped the rapes in Golden and Westminster. Weiner described to the women what the process ahead would entail if the case proceeded to trial. The public testimony. The tough cross-examination. The possibility that O'Leary might try to influence their mental states through words or gestures at trial. "Sex offenders are the biggest manipulators of human beings that there are," he warned. At times, the law could seem not to care much for victims. In the strictest legal sense, these crimes had been committed against the state, not the four women. Weiner would give great consideration to their concerns, but he was under no obligation to follow their desires. His client was the public. And O'Leary was innocent until proven guilty. The judge and the attorneys would give deference to his right to a fair trial. "Oftentimes, you'll be frustrated because it appears that the focus is not on you, but it's on the offender," Weiner told the four women. "Rest assured, it's not lost on us." Eventually, each of the women agreed, take the plea. Weiner thought it for the best. It would spare them the indignities of trial. And O'Leary would still face a long time in prison, his ultimate sentence to be determined by a judge. Before Weiner signed off on the deal, he asked once more, would O'Leary give him the password? Once more, the answer came back, no. O'Leary's sentencing was held on a freezing day in early December at the towering, curvilinear Jefferson County District Courthouse. You could see its sparkling glass dome from the apartment complex where O'Leary had raped Amber almost a year earlier. It was easy to imagine that O'Leary had glanced at it, looming against snow-covered Rockies during the hundreds of hours he stalked the graduate student. The small gray and brown courtroom brimmed with people. Galbraith, Hendershot, Burgess, and Grusing were there. So were Ellis and Shimamoto. Lily and Doris sat on one side. O'Leary's mother, stepfather, and sister sat on the other. O'Leary sat up front, at a long, shiny table directly in front of the judge. He had close-cropped hair, a black shirt, and a thick brown security belt. His long, pale face contorted violently every few minutes, a nervous tic that had the effect of squeezing all his facial features together toward his nose. Judge Philip McNulty sat up front. White hair framed his bald pate. In 15 years on the bench, he had earned a reputation for fairness, compassion, and a preternaturally calm demeanor. He would one day be appointed the district court's chief judge. McNulty called the court to order. The people of the state of Colorado versus Mark O'Leary had begun. Weiner spoke first. He painted a picture of a cool, methodical sociopath bent on increasing violence. He described how O'Leary had started with Doris in Aurora, how he failed with Lily in Lakewood, how he bought a gun after stealing cash from Sarah's Westminster apartment, how he threatened Amber with a similar-looking gun in Golden. This was a man who treated rape as a job he said he loved. This was a man who should be put away forever. The way Weiner figured it, O'Leary deserved a minimum of 294 years. The night before, Weiner had provided the judge with blown-up photos of the victims, partially redacted to protect their privacy. "Look at the faces of those victims, the pain and the torture that they went through. What he took from these women and the manner in which he took them can never, ever be replaced," he told McNulty. At the time of his arrest, O'Leary had been planning another attack in another Denver suburb, Weiner told the judge. Investigators had found his surveillance notes. "Like a wolf, he was a predator," Weiner said. O'Leary's victims went next. Galbraith and Hendershot read statements from Amber and Sarah. "The rape changed her," Amber's statement said. "She installed 3 locks on her door. She fastened them the moment she came home. She used to sleep with her windows open to catch the summer breeze. Now they were always closed. Holidays turned up terrible memories. Colors she once loved, the colors she had decorated her bedroom with, now reminded her of the rape." "I'm still in the process of forgetting this incident and moving on, but I am lucky to a point that the person who did this has been found," she wrote. "I don't need to live in fear anymore." Sarah had just been getting back on her feet when the attack happened. Her husband had died. She had moved into a new apartment. The rape stole even more from her. She thought her phone was tapped. She believed hackers had infiltrated her email. She became frightened when she saw an upstairs neighbor with a similar build to the man who raped her. She called them the losses in her life. Loss of freedom and safety. Loss of trust. Loss of a sense of peace. "This event has not defeated me. I was knocked down temporarily, but I'm back on my feet again. I may not do all of the things that I like to do. I'm much more vigilant, but I'm still alive, and I'm living my life." When Hendershot finished reading Sarah's statement, she turned to McNulty. She had an unusual request, one she'd made only a few times in her career. Could she offer a comment of her own? The judge said yes. Hendershot turned to the bench, but kept her gaze on O'Leary, hoping to catch his eye. "Sir, this crime has had a profound impact on my life, both personally and professionally," she said. "Mr. O'Leary demonstrated a level of arrogance and disdain that is incomprehensible. With each assault, there was no recognition of society's values and no ethical or moral compass." Hendershot asked the judge to put O'Leary away for life. The women O'Leary had attacked in Lakewood and Aurora rose to speak. Lily told the judge that she was a spiritual person, dedicated to prayer and worship and service to all of creation. But after the attack, she struggled to find that self. She couldn't be alone in her home. She had violent thoughts. She withdrew from friends. She hired armed guards to protect her home. She racked up medical bills for tens of thousands of dollars. She had no insurance. Collection agencies called constantly.